and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for June 18th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, how swine flu is changing in swine, taking noise into account when studying stresses on marine life, and violin makers take up the tools of science to study what makes great violins great. All of this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about ranking football or soccer players, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
It might be surprising to hear that even though the 2009 H1N1 pandemic influenza strain is known broadly as swine flu, scientists haven't found exactly how it traces back to swine. But there's no doubt that pigs have it now. They apparently caught it from us.
The additional finding that we observed was that the pandemic H1N1 virus reassorted with influenza viruses of pigs.
Malik Paris studies the virology of influenza at the University of Hong Kong. And in a paper in this week's Science, Paris and colleagues report the reassortment of pandemic H1N1 influenza virus in swine.
And this is not very surprising, but the fact that this has occurred highlights the fact that we need to be on the alert and be watchful for such events, because the pandemic virus might acquire changes of relevance to human public health in pigs.
Indeed, the H1N1 pandemic strain got the name swine flu because, genetically, it appears to be derived from several other virus strains that have been circulating in swine before the outbreak.
But yet the virus was isolated from a human, so it was a human influenza virus.
Marie Grammer is a veterinary diagnostician who researches swine influenza viruses at the University of Minnesota and is not associated with the study.
I'm saying that pigs are not playing a role in the spread of 2009 pandemic H1N1. And prior to the virus showing up in humans, there was no data that showed that that 2009 pandemic H1N1 came from any pig anywhere in the world.
Although previous influenza viruses have.
People have been looking at swine viruses for years. You know, the first influenza virus I ever isolated was from swine in 1930. In Iowa. And prior to that, you know, people didn't know what influenza virus was.
But of course, people have suffered and died from influenza long before that.
Influenza viruses reassort and they change all the time. And that's to be expected of a virus that's been around for over 1,000 years. The influenza virus always changes. If it didn't change, it wouldn't be a successful virus and we wouldn't always have to continue to look for it and update vaccines and update tests and make new plans.
And public health officials already have established a worldwide network of institutions and scientists, including study author Malik Paris, who look for influenza and its changes.
The pandemic H1N1 virus that we found in pigs, the pigs were apparently healthy, otherwise they wouldn't have come to the abattoir.
The slaughterhouse, where Paris and his team took samples as part of their monitoring efforts.
The reassortant virus that we found in pigs also was isolated from a healthy pig. And we have also taken that virus and experimentally infected pigs. And pigs infected with this reassorted virus also seemed quite normal to observation, although they were shedding the virus. And the only way we could see the effect of the infection is that the infected pigs had a slightly reduced weight gain. So these infections are broadly asymptomatic in pigs.
And Marie Grammer of the University of Minnesota agrees that this kind of genetic testing, although at some expense, is the best way at present to monitor how the virus changes.
The techniques are sound, and a lot of laboratories have these techniques available, you know, specifically taking virus isolates, sequencing each gene, and then comparing those genes that they obtain from those isolates to other genes in databases.
And in this study, Paris says that 7 of the 8 relevant genes from the virus are pig in origin, meaning that there's nothing to suggest that this particular virus strain that he and his team found is able to transmit back to humans.
Only 1 of these genes is pandemic virus in origin. However, the fact that this type of reassortment can occur means that other combinations of genes may also occur, and one may conceivably find a combination of genes between the pandemic and swine virus, which might have quite different properties in terms of being less severe or more severe, less transmissible or more transmissible in humans. So it doesn't necessarily mean that such a virus will successfully come back to humans or that it will be more virulent in humans, but I think that possibility is something that we need to be alert for. And the only way we can be alert for that is by global surveillance of pigs for influenza viruses. And I think I should emphasize that I doubt that what we saw is something unique to Hong Kong or to this part of the world. I suspect it is something that's going on in many parts of the world.
But both Paris and Grammer say that, of course, the knowledge of this reassortment and transmission among pigs, which likely has been happening for hundreds, if not thousands of years, does not increase the risk to human health. The knowledge just helps scientists better understand how to prepare and vaccinate. Again, Marie Grammer of the University of Minnesota.
So there's no systematic surveillance, so we don't know where these viruses are. Well, let's get systematic surveillance in and let's approach it from a One Health type of response with human, animal, and environmental health professionals working together to do this type of surveillance. Because to put the burden of surveillance on one particular group, I don't think the surveillance will get done to the levels that the other groups would like it to be.
Right now, though, that burden of surveillance is mostly carried by one particular group, the group whose primary focus is to look after the health of animals, which, like the pigs that Paris and his colleagues observed, may not themselves even be affected by a virus that could be, potentially, and given the right reassortment, a human public health hazard. You can read Paris and colleagues' paper, Reassortment of Pandemic 2009 H1N1 Influenza A Virus in Swine, in this week's Science. We have been probing the oceans for centuries, millennia even, but it's only been in the past few decades that scientists have started widespread, systematic studies to measure the effects our activities are having on the oceans. Sometimes that's because we didn't have the technology to carry out the studies, but other times it's because our activities are relatively new, too. For example, one way we're changing the oceans is with all the noise generated by our probes, our construction, and especially our commercial ships. Noise that marine ecologist Leela Hatch thinks should be considered in studies right alongside all of the other stressors we're placing on marine life. Freelancer David Malikoff, who writes about ocean noise in the special section on our changing oceans in this week's issue, spoke with Hatch from Massachusetts.
I'm Leela Hatch. I'm a marine ecologist, and I work at the Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary, one of 13 national marine sanctuaries that are designated due to their importance to the American people. This area makes up the majority of Massachusetts Bay between Cape Cod and Cape Ann and is very close to the very dense populations of Boston and surrounding towns. So it's a really urban area on shore, and it's a really heavily used area of the ocean offshore as well. And I am focused on the effects of underwater noise on marine life, but I also look at all kinds of other effects of human activities on different resources that are in the sanctuary, fish, whales, and all the habitats that they rely on.
So you are a marine ecologist by training?
Yes.
But you weren't trained in acoustics necessarily?
My title right now is marine ecologist. You know, I broadly work on different kinds of behavioral and ecological issues with marine life in the sanctuary. My degree is in evolutionary biology, just to be even more complicated. So I'm a population biologist by training that's interested in the evolution of animals and natural systems and predominantly how humans have affected those evolutionary trajectories. That's my training, and I did most of it in both genetics and acoustics.
And so how did that bring you to studying noise in the ocean?
Since the beginning of looking at acoustic tools, I have been interested in whales, and that's very frankly because as a teenager, I lived down the road from a professor at Cornell University who studies whale sound named Chris Clark. And when I was 16 and 17, started working with him on some of the recordings he was bringing back from the Arctic of bowhead whales and some of the recordings he had also made with teams of people for right whales off of South America. And so I was always interested in the sounds that these animals were making, and I was a singer as well, really loved music, and those things always kind of went together in my mind. And then as I started to become more and more interested in biology, I was looking for ways to put together those interests.
And why would noise be an issue for these whales?
The oceans are an incredibly acoustic place, and that is because sound travels so efficiently underwater. So if you're going to adapt well to the ocean environment, as whales have, you're going to adapt to use sound to communicate, in many cases over light, since light is in some ways nowhere near as efficient underwater. They use it to find mates, to find food, to navigate, all kinds of important roles. And that means that some of the things that humans do can interfere with the purposeful use of noise by animals.
Some people have described it as we create acoustic clutter or acoustic smog.
It's a good analogy, yes. People have their own experience of what crowded acoustic space is. All of us have been to a cocktail party that started with only a few people in a small space and allowed us to communicate fairly effectively between one another as we stand on the sidelines. As that room fills up, we have a much harder time talking to one another over that same distance and using the same intensity or the same loudness in our voice. We have to make some changes in either how we're standing, move closer together, or speak more loudly, other things to make ourselves heard over the background. And that's one of the main concerns that we have with the rising ocean noise.
Stretching that analogy to the ocean, how crowded a cocktail party has the ocean become?
The places where we have the best time series of data are off the north and central coasts of California. And here we have been measuring the intensity, that is the amplitude or loudness of sounds at different frequencies. Frequencies are tones. They're the keys on the piano. So we're looking at those very low tones on the piano, and we are interested in how the loudness overall in the background has increased over time. And we've started doing those measurements in the 1940s and 50s. And what that's shown us is that every decade, the sound appears to be increasing at those low frequencies by around 3 decibels. And now that might not sound like very much, but acoustics are measured on the decibel scale in an exponential way. So that 3 decibel increase actually represents a doubling of acoustic power every decade. So we're making quite substantial increases in that background hum. This isn't the time at which an intense acoustic sound is occurring. That's the short duration acoustic sound. It's not a big loud blast. This is that background hum. And that background hum is now getting louder and louder and louder over the period of time, predominantly that humans have been utilizing industrial shipping routes.
So you're saying that the background hum has increased and that the primary source of the background hum appears to be ships.
That's correct.
What does that mean in practical terms? So, for example, if a whale is using a low-frequency call.
What it means is that animals that use low frequencies, and this, again, are our larger baleen whales predominantly within the whale and dolphin group, we have theoretical understanding that a blue whale could be heard pole to pole. And there's only one instance in which there has been an example of that empirically, being able to actually hear a blue whale through what's called the deep sound channel, a channel created by different pressure and temperature conditions, that if a low-frequency sound wave enters that channel, it can propagate across large ocean basins without losing any energy at all.
So a blue whale calling off California theoretically could be heard off Japan.
Correct. Correct.
Pretty impressive.
It is pretty impressive. We are changing that probability because it's not only the ability of the sound to enter the deep sound channel. When it gets to the receiving end, we need to be able to hear it over background noise. So as we change that background noise condition, our ability and their ability to hear each other and our ability to detect that kind of a long-range transmission is decreased.
So what is the major source of noise from shipping? Is it the propellers or is it the engines themselves or...
Well, both of those mechanical sounds from within some of the ship's machinery are and can be dominant. In general, however, for, again, the low-frequency sound coming from large commercial carriers, it is the cavitation of bubbles coming off of propellers that seem to be one of the main drivers of underwater noise. And that efficiency of the propeller, which is directly related to just how much cavitation occurs, can be maximized or minimized in combination with its hull design. So when we actually look how to make things better, it's not usually just in isolation changing the propeller. It's usually changing the way the propeller works in conjunction with the hull.
And some of that is technologically feasible.
Some of that is very much technologically feasible. On the other hand, there has not been as much work in model basins to minimize noise production as a specific goal. And so there's quite a lot of room for improvement.
And looking forward, what do you think are some of the most interesting or biggest unanswered questions in the science of ocean noise? What kinds of studies would you like to see come down the line?
I'd like to see noise be brought into a better understanding of what cumulative impacts look like in the ocean environment. What I mean by that is most marine animals in coastal environments and even in some pelagic environments are not experiencing the effects of human activities in isolation, one stressor at a time. They are usually experiencing a whole concert of different things, whether it be chemicals or different forms of pollutants, exposure to noise energy, direct take. There's usually a whole bunch of things going on, and we need to do a better job as managers of bringing our understanding of what noise might be doing in the environment together with our understanding of what these other things are doing, so that when we are considering how to locate new human activity, how to manage the impacts of one human activity at a time, how to design mitigation and monitoring, that we're not treating any one stressor or any one activity in isolation.
Well, Leila, thanks so much.
Thank you, David. That was really fun.
Marine ecologist Leila Hatch speaking with freelancer David Malikoff, who writes on ocean noise and edits the news in this week's special section on our changing oceans. Find news, scientific reviews, and opinion concerning our changing oceans in this week's Science. Violin makers are taking up the tools of science to study their craft, studying great violins both in isolation, say in a computed tomography or CT scan, and when played, such as what you are hearing now. Wagner's Abumblatt, as played by Ilya Kahler on the Viatom violin, which is for sale for $18 million. Of course, that audio was compressed into an MP3 file, like the rest of the podcast, but Science's Adrian Cho was at Kahler's recital with the Viatom and other famous violins, and reports in this week's issue on what scientists and violin makers have learned, as well as the questions unanswered about what makes great violins great.
Scientists and violin makers have undertaken a study of one of the very best violins in existence, a violin made in 1741 by Giuseppe Guarneri del Gesù that's currently for sale for $18 million. And this is the latest example in a sort of movement in which violin makers and scientists are getting together to study some of the very best violins and trying to figure out what distinguishes a really great violin from a merely very good one, or what distinguishes, say, a Stradivarius from a Guarneri.
Who is pushing the study of these old violins?
So this actually is interesting times for violin makers and the research on the violin, because for decades, there's always been a handful of scientists who've been very interested in the physics and the science of the violin, but they haven't gotten that much attention from violin makers. And what's interesting now is that this current study of this violin, which is known as the Viatom, and these other studies are driven largely by violin makers. So violin makers are taking up the tools of science and the concepts of science and applying them to this craft that's been around for centuries. And you know, for hundreds of years, the best way to make a violin was simply to copy great old violins. And over the last several decades, physicists and engineers have actually come up with some very detailed measurements and a fairly detailed understanding of how the violin works. That information has been there and hasn't attracted that much interest from violin makers. Ironically, as these few researchers who've dedicated their careers to studying the violin are aging and retiring, it's only now that the violin makers are adopting these tools. So the interesting thing here is that there is a fair amount of research on these very fine instruments going on, but as the scientists say, it's being driven these days largely by the makers.
Has the goal of the violin makers changed? Copy the finest violins?
Well, I don't think so, right? I mean, I think that the really top-notch violin makers have always wanted to make the best instruments. But I think that they now see the scientific tools as a way to get a better insight into what the instrument is actually doing. Essentially, working with scientists is giving them a new vocabulary and a new way to look at their instruments. There are a number of advantages for the instrument makers here. Sam Zygmuntowicz, who's a maker in New York City, told me that what he likes about this approach is that, as he puts it, he essentially gets an R&D team, people with all these technical skills, to look at different things that he can put questions to and leverage their expertise to gain greater insights into the instrument. And Joseph Curtin, who's another one of the leading makers and who's in fact the fellow who started this current project, the study of the Viaton, you know, he told me that as a violin maker, to have a life of mind, you want to think about these sort of technical things and not simply copy what's been done before. So it's very interesting. When you talk to these violin makers, it's very much like talking to an engineer or talking to a physicist. Some of them really know their stuff. They really know what's going on in terms of the mechanical resonances of the instrument and how these resonances produce sound and how the resonances in modes interact. So it's essentially giving them another way to look at these instruments.
By using this scientific approach, what are these teams of scientists and violin makers learning that's new?
From my reporting, it seems that the scientists at least believe that while they can say what sort of the basic defining properties and functions of a violin are, you know, what makes a violin as opposed to a guitar, there isn't so far any obvious answer as to why an instrument made by Stradivari or Guarneri del Gesù is a great instrument, while one made by, you know, a very top-flight modern maker may not be considered so great. And obviously a lot of this may just come down to culture and legend and whatnot, but people are looking for these sort of scientific answers for some basis to distinguish between the two, and that's really where these current efforts come in. So as part of this study with the Viaton, the people doing the study arranged for this recital where Ilya Kahler, a noted soloist, played the Viaton. He played a Stradivarius and a couple of other Guarneri del Gesù's, and a violin by Guadagnini.
And I understand in the online version of this article, there's video footage.
That's right. So as part of the test, they had Kahler play the same piece of music on several old Italian violins, including the Viaton. And so if you listen to these, first of all, they all sound fantastic. They all sound perhaps slightly different, too, but quantifying those differences may be very tough. So, for example, here is Kahler playing the first movement of Tchaikovsky's violin concerto on the Viaton.
And, of course, this has been compressed into an MP3. You can hear a more true-to-form version in the online version of this article on our website.
And here is Kahler playing the same piece of music on another violin by Giuseppe Guarneri del Gesù.
Okay, so by the same violin maker there, all right?
That's right. And here is the same piece of music played on a Stradivarius. And a Stradivarius has a reputation for being a slightly sweeter instrument than a Guarneri.
So differences more than a musician could hear at close range.
I have to admit that when I sat there and listened to them from close range, they sounded very different. I have to admit that hearing them in sound files, when it's the exact same piece of music, it's much more subtle. But the makers and the musicians in particular will tell you that they can tell differences, especially when they're up close. It must be said that all of the science of the violin is very slippery because, as everybody, especially the scientists, are fond of pointing out, these subtle differences, which you can hear at very close range because the air is absorptive, and more so for higher frequencies, a lot of these little subtleties should in fact be washed out by the time the sound reaches you if you're sitting in the 23rd row in an auditorium. So it's all very subtle.
So what have scientists learned so far?
Well, so far, the studies of violins have mostly been made on violins in isolation. So for instance, people have measured the spectra of these great violins. They've measured their modes of vibration. People have put violins through CAT scans, and it appears that the difference between the density and the light and the dark rings in the tops of the really old violins, that difference is smaller than in modern violins, suggesting that the instruments are more homogeneous. And for the most part, the spectra, the sound output of these really fine violins is not all that different from poorer violins, some of them downright bad. They all have the same basic set of low-frequency modes. They all have this clumping called the bridge hill. The spectrum for the old violins tends to be more even, so the violin tends to put out somewhat more evenly at all frequencies, although it's very, very far from putting out, you know, with a flat response at all frequencies. That would make for a truly terrible violin by all accounts. Also, one of the low-frequency resonances tends to be stronger in the old violins than the modern violins. It also appears that the vibrations in the old violins tend to damp out a little faster. They tend to die away faster than in the new violins, although it's not clear whether that's due to the material properties of the wood or whether it's just because of differences, say, in the mass of the violins. The old violins tend to be a little bit lighter. So there are these sort of tantalizing suggestions that there's something that you can tease out of the details of this analysis. But I think it's safe to say there's nothing that stands out so far that says, this is the fingerprint of a Strad, this is the fingerprint of a Guarnerian, this is why these old violins are so much better, at least by reputation, than the new ones.
Does the quality of the player, the violinist, make a difference?
In fact, it may be that the similarities between the old instruments and the new instruments may be actually telling people more about how the instruments have been tested so far than about the differences in the instruments. These are tests that are usually made with a violin in isolation, perhaps suspended by rubber bands in an anechoic chamber or, you know, put through a CAT scan, something like that. When in fact, if you watch on the Science website the clips of Collar playing the violin, you'll see that, you know, he's got it clamped under his chin, he's got his hand wrapped around the neck, and there's an enormous physical interaction between the violinist and the violin, and there's a lot going on there. That's really tough to study because you can tap a violin and you can measure its sound output spectrum relatively easily, but once you've got the violin in this very, you know, idiosyncratic situation with the violinist's hand around the neck and the bow on the string, it becomes much, much harder to do controlled experiments. So I think that there is some recognition amongst the scientists and the violin makers that that's perhaps where these distinctions will, you know, finally be found, right? That perhaps the old violins react to the violinist in some way that newer ones and poorer ones don't, that somehow it's a dynamical quality that's the difference between a Strad and, you know, a factory-made instrument or something like that.
Adrian Cho, thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob.
Science's Adrian Cho reports in this week's issue on how violin makers are taking up the tools of science to study their craft to learn what makes great violins great. Find videos of tests of the violins, as well as an excerpt from the recital in the online version of the article. Special thanks to Eugene Schenkman for providing the recordings. Finally today, David Graham, online news editor of Science Magazine, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about using science to rank football stars.
Or soccer, as we call it here in the U.S., Rob.
Okay. So how are scientists doing this?
Well, the problem with soccer, and I'm going to say soccer, Rob, is that it's very hard to get statistics on individual players. It's not like football or baseball where you have a number of different variables, you know, how many times somebody hit the ball and where the ball went and whether they scored and things like that. First of all, soccer, as you know, is a very low-scoring game, usually only a few points per game. And second of all, because there's so few points, there's usually only one or two players that are making the goals. And so you have very little data to work with. And so when people usually talk about, you know, who are the best soccer players, it's sort of more of an intuitive observation than anything based on hard data or hard stats like you have in some of the other sports. So a team of researchers, all of whom happen to be big soccer fans, by the way, wanted to see if they could come up with a way to better rank soccer players. And what they did was they actually turned to Facebook and other social networks. They focused on the fact that soccer is really a team sport. In other words, even when that goal is made, it took a lot of players to get the ball to that eventual point. So players were passing to other players and they were passing to other players until a goal was eventually made or at least attempted.
So the soccer team as a social network.
Exactly. The soccer team as a social network. How do all these players sort of interact with each other to achieve this eventual goal of moving the ball down the field and making that goal? And the team looked beyond just making the goal. They said, you know, let's just look at even moving the ball down the field, because even a player that can help move the ball all the way down the field, even if that ball doesn't make a goal, is probably a very skilled player. And that helped them not be limited to just
having a couple goals a game, they were really able to focus on the back and forth across the soccer field, which obviously happens multiple times throughout the game.
So what's the ranking then? How are these scientists ranking these players?
Well, Rob, if you think of each link that would normally be a link between people in a social network, essentially representing the ball being passed from player to player, as those links get closer to the goal, the more highly ranked a player becomes.
Because the defenders who are often passing the ball back and forth at the back of the field, maybe they're not going to get the same kind of ranking as a striker who's near the goal.
Exactly.
In applying this, have the researchers found that their ranks match up with these intuitive observations?
They did. They actually found that the indices that they came up with closely match the assessments of sports reporters, coaches, and even other experts who have, you know, weighed in.
So we've got a new paradigm, perhaps, for placing bets on World Cup matches?
Well, at least one of the researchers who's from Portugal says it may help him feel a little bit better about a recent match his team played in the current World Cup. Apparently they didn't play very well, but he says, you know, maybe if I apply my model to this match, we may play a little better than I thought.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. So what other stories have we brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from the world of soccer to the world of Saturn, this next story is about some relatively new moons that are orbiting this giant planet and what they mean for how moons form in our solar system.
Relatively new. How long ago are we talking about here?
Well, Rob, these moons are only 10 million years old, which may seem like a lot of time, but when you consider that our solar system is billions of years old, it's really just like yesterday that these moons formed. And that's really surprising to scientists because they assumed that all the moons in our solar system, and indeed all of the planets in our solar system, formed from this sort of primordial cloud of gas and dust, and it all condensed, and the moons condensed at the same time that the planets did, and some of the planets, because of their gravity, captured some of these moons, which is why moons are around planets today.
And so with Saturn, moons are still forming, what, out of the rings?
Well, that's what scientists have found out. They found seven tiny moons, and Saturn has 55 major bodies orbiting it. So this is just a small fraction of the number of bodies that are orbiting this planet. But they found that seven tiny moons orbiting either just beyond or inside the planet's rings had a much different composition than other moons in the solar system. They have almost what the scientists call a Swiss cheese composition, which means they're a lot less dense than other moons. And that was the first clue to scientists that these moons didn't form when all the other moons did from this primordial disk of gas and dust, just because those moons tend to be a lot more dense. So they began looking at Saturn's rings, and they said, you know, is it possible, because there's so much dust in Saturn's rings, could these moons have formed from the rings? They ran some computer models, and in their simulations, they showed that that was actually possible, that these moons could have formed from the grains of dust and the ice crystals that also orbit Saturn. And essentially what happens is that these grains of dust and ice form these small clumps, and as the clumps get bigger, this object begins to have its own gravity, which draws in even more clumps, and you have this sort of snowball effect until eventually you end up with these small moons.
So this process is still ongoing.
Well, that's a really intriguing implication from this research, because not only does it say that there are very young moons in our solar system, but it means that, you know, this gas and this dust are still around Saturn, which means that moons could still be forming at this very moment.
Is this providing any insight into the moons that are older then, or were those formed in different ways?
Well, another interesting implication from this is when Earth was very young, a Mars-sized body slammed into it, creating an orbiting cloud of dust like we see around Saturn. So it's even possible that our own moon formed in the same way.
Okay. So last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from the world of Saturn back to the world of Earth, except this time an Earth without flowering plants.
It wouldn't be nearly as pretty.
It wouldn't be nearly as pretty, and it would also be a lot drier, researchers have found.
Why?
Well, plants in general tend to be very good plumbers. They suck up water from the ground, and this water evaporates through the leaves and enters the atmosphere.
And flowering plants differ in this ability compared to other plants?
Exactly. Flowering plants, and when we're talking flowering plants, we're talking about plants like elms and oaks, tulips and roses, have even better plumbing than most other plants. And in fact, they represent most of the vegetation here on Earth. These plants transpire so much water that they essentially create their own rain. In fact, 10% of the moisture in the atmosphere comes from plants. And, you know, when you're thinking about so much rain and the impact that rain has on climate and ecology, researchers of this study said I wonder what the world would look like if there weren't any of these flowering plants around.
So this has to be a computer simulation.
It is. It definitely is. No other way to do it, I would think. What they did was they worked with some climate models, and they essentially took these flowering plants out of the climate models. And what this did was reduced transpiration by about 75% overall. And what they found is that some regions of the world were affected much more dramatically than others. For instance, eastern North America received about 30 to 50% less precipitation than it does right now. But the biggest impact was really in tropical areas, areas that obviously have a lot of these plants. Places like the eastern Amazon basin, the length of the wet season was decreased by nearly 3 months, and the extent of a lot of these rainforests also was cut dramatically. Some of them shrank by as much as 80%. So really dramatic effects just by cutting out these flowering plants.
So that helps us understand a world before flowering plants, but that was a very different world for a lot of other reasons too, right?
Exactly. You know, we're not just talking about a much drier world without these plants, but because rainfall is so important to biodiversity. I mean, think of a desert where you have very little rainfall and how very few animals live there versus the number of animals and the number of species you see in something like a rainforest. The researchers say, you know, it's not just that the world is wetter because of these plants. The world just has a lot more species in it because of these plants.
So potential implications as we cut down rainforests, for example.
Exactly. You can imagine, at least based on this study, that cutting down the rainforest could actually significantly impact climate.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into on the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got stories about the chronology of Egyptian kings. It's been a very hard thing to nail down, but now radiocarbon dating is helping researchers figure out exactly which kings reigned when. And also a story about whale feces and how it is actually helping to fight global warming. And on Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've really been focusing a lot on the oil spill. We've got an entire page dedicated to it. What's happening to the oil? We had some recent stories about some interesting new strategies that researchers have proposed for stopping the spill once and for all. And also what's going on in the political environment. President Barack Obama gave a speech earlier this week about what he intends to do in terms of combating the oil spill and its effects on the ecosystems. And we'll have some stories about what role scientists are playing in these initiatives. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the June 18th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.